Hi, it's Wednesday, 1st of April. I'm Hannah Pearson from Pear Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bauman from Check In Asia.
On today's show from Lockdown Malaysia, we're going to avoid all mention of the dreaded C word.
COVID-19.
And focus instead on the photogenic side of tourism. Yes, today we're talking travel selfie culture. And we'll also announce the launch of our new project, the Cheat Sheet, but more on that later.
So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. Well, there's next to no travel in Southeast Asia or anywhere else at the moment. So social media uploads tend to focus more on home-cooked meals, shopping in supermarkets, and ways to entertain and educate the kids.
But we're all hoping that the pause button on our mobile phone cameras is just temporary. And once the lockdowns, the travel bans, and the airline groundings are reversed, we'll see an unleashing of selfie uploads as pent-up trip demand is unplugged.
So this week, we're taking a look behind the lens at travel selfies in Southeast Asia. So Gary, travel and photography have always gone hand in hand throughout history. And let's be honest, we all like a good selfie or weefy from time to time. So what's your standout travel memory?
Well, you're right. I don't take many selfies, I have to admit, but I've taken a few. I think probably a couple from Southeast Asia that stand out would be one I took last year in Bangkok. We were on quite late at night on a rooftop bar, just overlooking the city. And it just looked fabulous. It was a totally black, but a very clear night. There were lights everywhere. It looked a bit Gotham, but it was just a fantastic backdrop. And you just realize just, you know, what an impressive city that is from high up above. So I quite like that one. I think the other one was one I took, it was a few years back, but I think it's 2011 when I visited Burma, Myanmar, for the first time. And I took the train overnight from Yangon to Bagan. And we woke up in the morning, it was a really bumpy, long, I think it was a 16-hour journey overnight. And we woke up in the morning and we'd stopped in literally the middle of nowhere. There were people selling snacks and stuff, but we stopped there for about 40 minutes and there was no sign of when we were going to move again. So I just got off the train, walked around a bit and took a few pictures with local people. And that was great fun. That was a nice moment because you literally did feel like you're in the middle of nowhere.
Nice.
And what about you? It's my turn to ask you. Where and when was the photo memory that you treasure most?
I think it's got to be in Bhutan, really. So I went there back in 2013. Wow, 7 years ago now. And, you know, it's that iconic temple up on the cliffside there that, you know, everybody just wants to go see and wants to have their photo taken. And it was just a really special moment. And you're like, yeah, I've really seen Bhutan now, just that one temple. But you think, yeah, I've been to somewhere unusual that not everybody has managed to make it to. So that was really special.
Well, I'm very jealous of that. That would be one place. It would be very high on my travel wish list and my photo wish list as well. But yeah, it's beautiful. So yeah. The backdrops were natural fresh air, beautiful mountains.
Yep. Yeah, it was fantastic. What a good trip.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, as you mentioned there a few minutes ago, Hannah, travel and photography are very closely aligned. Virtually every travel magazine around the world runs an annual photo competition. TV shows and websites invite people to send in their own snaps. And of course, airline publications are filled with people's travel photos.
Yeah, exactly. And the advent of social media has changed that a little bit though, hasn't it? Because now everybody has the opportunity to upload their own photos, present them to the world. You know, they don't just have to send them into a magazine and hope that they're going to be selected. They get to just choose exactly what image they want and upload it there and then with that kind of instant gratification.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen probably over the last 5 years, but certainly the last 10 years, this real explosion of travel selfie culture. And it's getting stronger and busier all the time. But if we sort of take a little bit of a step back, let's look at what were the key points in the history. How did this all come about? Because we've always all taken photographs on holidays, but never to the point where we put ourselves in the picture so much. So I guess the key point really was 2007 with the launch of the iPhone.
Yeah.
I mean, that really brought photography to the palm of your hand and into your pocket as well. And
yep.
No longer did we have to carry around these heavy cameras and bother with, you know, numerous switches and settings. I know that there are a lot of professional photographers out there that will completely disagree with this, because they still believe, obviously, it's their profession.
Yeah, that DSLR still.
That picture should be
on their necks.
Yeah, that picture should be properly framed and, you know, properly set, and that's absolutely right. But
yeah, I mean, nowadays it's a very easy point and press, see and snap. That's how everybody does it. And, you know, and at that time, and Facebook existed.
Yep.
You know, it was founded in 2004. But it still didn't really gain critical mass until the late 2000s. But I still remember, actually, even back in, university. So that was 2007, just starting. You know, you were uploading all of your photos, all your travel photos onto Facebook, but it took a long time.
Yeah, absolutely true. So, I mean, those were two key points with the founding of the iPhone and the setting up of Facebook, which gave us the platform to do that. But then I guess the two biggest influences, one from the West and one from the East, are Instagram and WeChat.
Yes.
Would you agree with that? Yeah. So
yeah, I would do, yeah.
They were founded around about the same time. So it was interesting that you said that Facebook didn't really gain much traction until sort of towards the end of the 2000s, up towards 2010. Well, Instagram was actually founded in San Francisco in 2010, and it was later purchased by Facebook in 2012. It is, you know, probably the primary global application for taking photographs and posting them online. And various estimates suggest there are over 1 billion users worldwide right now, which is just an astonishing figure. And then we look to China. Well, you know, the Chinese travel outbound revolution was probably the story of the 2010s. And that has been very much facilitated by WeChat, which started as a messaging service in Shenzhen back in 2011. And is now this sort of multifunctional messaging, media, photography, shopping and lifestyle services sort of mega app. And apparently at the end of 2009, it was officially claiming that it had about 1.16 billion monthly users.
Yeah, I mean, and that's an astonishing number, isn't it? Considering that it's mainly just the Chinese-speaking market who are using that. You know, Instagram's 1 billion worldwide, WeChat is still predominantly East Asia.
Yeah. And so if you put those two figures together, which is very unscientific, you know, that's about 2.2 billion people. Although I have to say that I do know a lot of Chinese travelers do use Instagram as well. So there is an overlap.
Yeah. And from those two selfie apps really came this proliferation of other photo apps, image editors, filter tools. And, you know, when you take it one step further, you look at short videos. So you've got things like Snapchat, TikTok, live streaming, and now we've even got the dronies. So that's high-definition images that are shot by self-guided drones.
That's very true. And we've also got the wearable phenomenon as well, cameras that you can use where you put them on your head or on your body, sort of GoPro, for example, which are used for those sort of in-the-moment adventure and activity selfies you know, that show that you're really doing something unusual, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and they're so fun to watch, aren't they? All the GoPro stuff.
They really are. They're absolutely hypnotic when you start watching them. So let's take this back. Let's come back to Southeast Asia, Hannah. We've sort of been planning to do this theme podcast on sort of travel selfie culture for quite a while. And then we came across a couple of articles that sort of heightened our interest.
Yeah, that's true. So the first article we came across was the 50 most Instagrammable places in the world for 2020. And that was published by Big Seven Travel. And they did that based on the volume of related hashtag postings and some other algorithm. But it was pretty cool because Sydney came in number one, but there were actually five Southeast Asian locations that made the top 50. So Singapore came number five, Bali number eight, KL number 14, Palawan 36 in the Philippines, and Halong Bay in Vietnam 43rd.
Yeah, that's great to get those five. I mean, I'm surprised there wasn't a little bit more, to be honest. I mean, it's such a photogenic region. But the second article that grabbed our attention was in the Jakarta Post in Indonesia a few weeks ago on the 3rd of March, and it was titled "Behind the Internet Sensations: Indonesia's tourist sites that are marred by fame." So what stood out for you from that article, Hannah?
I mean, I think it was interesting because it talks about three different tourism spots.
Yeah.
And each of these had a slightly different story. So one of them was originally a place for sand and rock mining called Ranu Manduro. And this was not a tourism site at all. It's just that somebody happened to take a video, they put on some cool music over the top, and it really showcased these beautiful green hills, like you would see actually as something like in New Zealand.
Yep.
So it's quite unexpected landscape, I think, in Indonesia. And just because of that, you know, everybody started descending on this little place that's not built at all for tourism, you know, clogging up the sites, leaving loads of plastic waste. And the other site was one of the ones that caught my eye from this article was this amaryllis garden in Yogyakarta. So amaryllis is a kind of flower.
Yep.
And this is back in 2015, and it came out that the flowers are really in full bloom, so they're at their height of their beauty. And you know, all of these tourists descended, they were picking the flowers as they were taking selfies, trampling on them, ruining them, and getting a lot of criticism. But the site actually later learned, and for later years it actually built special visitor facilities and everything else. And it was really interesting to see these kind of spots that were not at all touristy really to start off with. And they're just having their infrastructure completely overwhelmed because everybody was sharing these photos on Instagram.
Yeah.
And it's how did the sites cope with that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting point. And, you know, the first article that we mentioned there was the 50 most Instagrammable places in the world. Well, Indonesia is such a vast archipelago. You could easily have 50 absolutely stunning Instagrammable places from that one country alone. So we picked out two or three other ones. I mean, one of the popular ones, one of the over recent years, is in Kuta, which is sort of traveler central for Bali. And on the beach on the beach there at sunset, if you stand there around about 7 p.m. every night, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of people pointing their cameras at the sky. But there are a couple of other ones that I thought were quite interesting as well. One is the Menora Hills, which is near Yogyakarta, as you mentioned just there. It's this sort of mountain backdrop. It's a beautiful place. And I actually did a piece on this a couple of years ago because they actually set up these two platforms that actually enabled you to actually perfectly curate your picture. You could get your angle right. They also had like professional photographers, and they also set up two actual camera podiums that actually would take the shots for you, so you got your perfect selfie. I mean, it is a stunning backdrop. There's like hills, and there's a rainforest, and there's a reservoir in the background. It's absolutely beautiful. But you know, this really is tailoring to people who can't even be bothered to get their own pictures right. And the other one. Well, absolutely. And the other one, which is absolutely fascinating, which I didn't know about until I went there earlier in the year, is the Lempuyang Temple, which is also in eastern Bali. Now, over recent years, you've seen loads of these pictures everywhere, where there's this huge gate, this angular sort of high gate that you walk through. And it's got this view of the volcano at the back. And the way that the pictures are often taken is it looks like you actually stood in front of a very placid lake or a sheet of glass, because it actually there's this mirror effect that makes it look. It's a stunning effect. But what I actually found out is the way they actually do it is you hand your camera, your mobile phone to a guy there, and he basically uses this small piece of plastic with a glass mirror on it, and he takes the picture for you. So he basically mirrors the picture. So all you're basically seeing is you stood by a gate with a volcano in the background, and he layers this mirror onto your pictures. It's very, very clever.
There's a whole industry around it, isn't it?
Yeah, the selfie industry. Yeah, really true.
I mean, and I think that got us also thinking about what are the key selfie spots here in Malaysia. And of course, I think the classic reference is, you know, the Penang Street Art, which made its debut a few years ago, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Back in 2012, I think, Penang was, the backstory is that Penang was named as a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 2008. And it was starting to develop tourism, but Penang is really small. Its old historic center is beautiful. It's absolutely stunning, and it's by the sea. It is such an atmospheric place. But it was trying to find a way to offer a bit more to tourists. So it commissioned a Lithuanian artist called Ernest Sarkarovich to come and paint some murals which were his own interpretation of the city's history and its art, its culture, its industry, which are fascinating. So he's put them all around the city on sort of walls, at the side of shop houses, down alleyways. There's one street called Armenian Street, which has become sort of this sort of self-essential because there's loads of these murals around there.
Yeah.
But it was quite an interesting phenomenon. It's garnered huge amount of attention online. And it sort of set the trend for this mural tourism, which we've started to see across other places of Malaysia.
Yeah, I mean, and especially across Malaysia, I guess, because, you know, everybody has seen the success that Penang has had and they want to copy that. So in Ipoh, which is, you know, an old tin mining town, it's about a 2.5-hour drive away from KL, in the middle of Malaysia, really. Again, they've started to have all of these murals coming up, I think hoping that people are going to go on a heritage trail and check those out. In KL, lots of street murals have started to appear too, you know, in Chinatown.
Yeah.
Even the back streets of Bukit Bintang, which is kind of the Golden Triangle, the central business hub. And even out in the suburbs, so in Selangor, which is the state that surrounds KL, they've got Laman Seni 7, which are all of these colourful arts installations. There's about 30 installations that they've created expressly for people to go and take their photos with. And like I said, these are not really even places that you would go as a tourist, especially this one out in Selangor. But they're trying to make it a hub. You know, they're trying to generate tourism around that. And I mean, in a way that's quite beneficial because it's going to benefit locals who've got F&B stands around there, boost more people, boost more footfall. So I can see what they're doing, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the other issue, the slight downside is that, you know, a lot of these are in residential areas. So you've got people queuing up outside people's houses to take pictures from, you know, murals that are on the side of their house. But, you know, as we've seen in Penang and Ipoh, you know, a lot of these people turn those houses into cafes to benefit from it.
Yes. Yeah. So it's getting that fine line, isn't it? Because you could now argue Penang has almost lost some of its charm because it's become so kind of gentrified with so many little cafes instead of people actually living there. But that's a whole other story.
Yeah, that is a whole other story. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So I guess over the last 2 years, one country has made two big headlines, actually, on this sort of selfie cultural travel, and that's Vietnam.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm sure most people, and we'll put this up on our blog as well, have seen that classic bridge that Vietnam built, which is called the Go Vang Bridge. And this is that one where the hands, these giant stone hands, are supporting this kind of cabled bridge. And that's interesting because it was built expressly to entice tourists. So it's part of a $2 billion project. It's near Da Nang to make tourists go there.
Yeah.
And if you contrast that with one of the other Instagram hotspots, which is Hanoi Train Street.
Yep.
And now this is actually a street that has always been there.
Yep.
And it used to be a very run-down area of Hanoi. Squats basically were there.
Yep.
But then some tourists kind of came along and they noticed that there's a train track going through this little alleyway. And people are essentially living their lives, you know, in the street. They've got all of their streetwear out, everything else. And then two or three times a day, I think it is, this train comes along the street. Everybody takes in all of their stuff quickly and the train passes by. And then life goes back to normal again in the street.
Yep.
So people started taking pictures of that. And it actually got so busy that they've now closed it. Yep. Citing safety concerns.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you've got this kind of purposely created, you know, selfie hotspot. And on the other, you had one that was kind of discovered accidentally, but is now being closed because it doesn't have the proper infrastructure around it and it's probably inconveniencing the locals as well.
Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, by any nature, the Golden Bridge is a horrific piece of architecture. It's curved, it's gold color, it's stuck in the middle of this beautiful backdrop again. It's got sort of hills and mountains and stuff behind it. And it's a very gaudy looking thing, but it was done specifically for this purpose, to attract people to go there and take pictures there. And it seems to have worked. It's actually fulfilled its purpose.
Yeah, it has. So I guess well done whoever designed it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, kudos to them for that.
Yeah.
So where else? Where else have we selfie hotspots here in Southeast Asia? Well, I guess the gold standard, the absolute number one, is Angkor Wat in Cambodia, the ancient temples, the ancient Khmer temples. Although obviously, like everywhere else at the moment, Angkor Wat is suffering. I noticed that in the last two months, visitation is down 37% year on year. So it's looking, you know, it's quite gloomy there. But one of the interesting things about Angkor Wat is, I mean, obviously the architecture is stunning. It's beautifully restored and renovated. They've done a great job there. It's ferociously hot because it's right in the middle of a sort of sun trap area. But there is one part of this area, of this temple area, called Ta Prohm, which became famous because there's this huge tree with all these roots that stick out from it. Yeah, exactly. So it engulfs this wall. And it was featured in the Tomb Raider movie with Angelina Jolie, which now, I mean, we're talking about selfie culture today. That was back in 2001. That's two decades ago.
Wow. Yeah, and people are still going there. You know, when I went to Angkor Wat a few years ago, that was one of the top places that I wanted to go to, exactly just for that feeling to be able to have said that you've been. Where else? I mean, if we're talking about Singapore, obviously you've got Marina Bay.
Yep.
And that's always got a bit of a dear spot in my heart because that's where I got engaged.
Oh, right. Okay.
So, personal one for me, but yeah, I took plenty of selfies myself at Marina Bay.
You've got
Chinatown, the Fullerton, of course, having a Singapore Sling as well at Raffles.
Yeah. The cable car over the city as well that goes down to down to the island. That has some great views from up there as well. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Similarly to the Hanoi's Train Street, you've also got the Mike Long Railway Market in Bangkok.
Very true.
That same kind of concept.
Yeah. Very colourful.
What else? Yeah, exactly. You've got the Shwe Dagon, hopefully I said that right, temple in Yangon.
Yeah, that's a beautiful temple. That's just bright gold, and at sunset people go there because the sun glints off it at all different angles. It's a very, very, very scenic and obviously a very spiritual place.
Yes. And what else? The rice terraces in the Philippines, in Cordillera.
Yeah, they're beautiful. I mean, they just go on for miles and miles and miles. They just slope beautifully, and they're just so well manicured. They are perfect for taking selfies.
And you've even got, you know, sunset, even in Laos. Laos has got its own spot as well. So sunset on a hilltop overlooking Wang Prabang.
Yeah.
There's so many selfie spots. And I think that's just everybody, you know, when they visit these places, they have to go to that place to get the shot, don't they? To say that they have been, they have done it.
Yep. And you've got the visual evidence to prove it.
Yeah, exactly.
But another trend that we see, I guess it's sort of underestimated, is we look at the hotspots, we look at places where, you know, obviously there's a reason why people are taking selfies there, because there's a natural site, or it's beautifully designed, or it's an architectural sort of landmark or something like that. But one of the underestimated hotspots is airports. I mean, we see people taking pictures all the time. You know, you're taking selfies and groupies when you actually arrive at the airport, in the departure hall, waiting at the gate, boarding the flight, when you actually take your seat on the flight, when you're in flight, when you're landing, and obviously next to the airport name board when you actually arrive in your destination. I mean, that's a huge chain of selfie images.
And imagine the number of selfies if you get upgraded to business class.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Yeah, you get your champagne glass right beside your face.
Yes. I mean, of course, there are downsides, aren't there, to all of this selfie tourism. So you've got things like over-tourism that is contributing to, we were talking about in Indonesia already, that the infrastructure is not built up enough there to be able to cope with a sudden influx of people.
Yep.
You have lots of litter problems, and there was even hashtag trash tag.
Yeah.
Which, you know, people were taking pictures of plastic waste on the beaches in Bali. And almost kind of shaming the government authorities to do something about it.
There was that's a big problem. There was a report by one of the environmental organizations pretty recently, I think it was the beginning of this year, where it named the five countries in the world that were actually responsible for the most amount of plastic waste that was going into the oceans. And two of those were in our region. Two of them, they were Vietnam and Indonesia.
Oh, really?
Mm.
Yeah. Though, I mean, with Indonesia, I guess a lot of this plastic waste is coming from other tourists, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of it washes up. It circulates around, doesn't it? But yeah. So certainly in Indonesia, it's an island. You know, it's a nation of so many islands. A lot of that trash does circulate around between the different islands, and obviously from other parts of mainland Southeast Asia as well. But we've seen other stories, you know, that have grabbed global headlines around the world. If you think of Maya Beach in Thailand, you know that was famous from the book The Beach and then the movie The Beach, and that had to get closed simply because it was being overused, over photographed. The same happened on Boracay, the White Beach there. In Indonesia, the Komodo Island, which is famous for the Komodo dragons, was going to be closed. The government announced that they would close it to allow for regeneration, but then they reversed that process. I guess at the moment that it's actually probably closed anyway, because I doubt anybody's actually going there. So maybe that regeneration is happening.
Yeah, the parks are closed. And even in Myanmar, Bagan, you know, it's you know, a place that is so iconic now from photos with all of the temples. But you've got issues there because the government saw that so many people are going there. They wanted to put it into a more, you know, get it into more of a ship shape, kind of polished look. So they started rebuilding some of these ancient temples with very little regard to the original monument, you know, much to the horror of archaeologists worldwide, but that they're doing this, you know. And it even got to the extreme that when tourists were banned from standing on certain structures to get that, you know, sunset shot over the temples, the vice minister for tourism, was adamant that this ban would seriously impact the tourism sector. That's what he said. So that's how much, you know, tourism authorities and governments are really considering, if you don't have that opportunity to get that selfie spot, that perfect photo spot, it's not going to be a good place for tourism. Tourists are not going to enjoy themselves and not go to visit.
Yeah, absolutely. Bagan has quite a difficult and quite tragic history, really, because this actually predates the current selfie trend. If you go back, I think about 30 years ago, obviously Myanmar was a very closed country. It was very poor, and it had a very bad earthquake, which damaged a lot of these temples pretty badly. They were pretty derelict anyway. As part of the efforts to rebuild the economy, they applied to UNESCO for Bagan to be made a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And it was actually turned down because, for the reason that you just said, they'd started to rebuild a lot of these temples and their actual original structures were compromised. So this went back and forth for a number of years. And then obviously after the global sanctions were lifted, I think in 2010, a lot of people started traveling back to Bagan. I went there in 2010, did the same thing, took the selfie on top of one of the temples at sunset. But you could see that a lot of the temples have been rebuilt, and quite clumsily in some cases. Some of the original structures are still there, and they're absolutely stunning, but they are in a ruined state. I think that Bagan again applied to become a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and you know, I think it may have had success in doing that, but you know, it has been quite a tragic history there. And where it goes from here is, you know, there are a lot of hotels that have been built around the site as well. It's become much more commercial, obviously, because people do want to go there. It's a beautiful place. It's a long story, and I guess it will, you know, it's still to be continued.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and then you've also even got the flip side of selfie tourism, that if you're uploading all of these selfies, you know, your image is going to be captured for facial recognition marketing, maybe other sinister motives. You know, it's you don't know what will happen, right? You put all of that information about yourself up there online.
Yeah, I mean, that's very, very true. But as we said, you know, over the last 4 or 5 years, you know, this selfie culture has really actually become an important part of marketing, the way that tourism boards, hotels, airlines, airports, destinations, everything, the way that they rely on marketing, because it's free. You know, you get good pictures, you get good take-up, you get peer recommendations, you get sharing of images around the world. You know, it has quite an important effect.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see so many tourism boards that are running, you know, campaigns based on user-generated content. So one of the classics, I guess, was It's More Fun in the Philippines, which was a few years back now already, wasn't it, where they encouraged people to take lots of snaps of themselves having more fun in the Philippines. But even, you know, last year you saw people like Wonderful Indonesia, Indonesian Tourism Board, teaming up with TikTok to run campaigns encouraging people to visit the top 10 sites that they wanted to promote in Indonesia. You see travel shows with, you know, designated selfie corners where people can dress up as Harry Potter or take a selfie in a sakura garden or pretend that they're skiing or a myriad of things.
Absolutely. I mean, those points that you just mentioned there, you know, the Harry Potter images and the Japanese sakura garden images, I mean, those were at the Kluk travel show, which did a sort of road show around Southeast Asia early last year, I believe. And, you know, that's very much aimed at a younger sort of, not even millennial audience. They're looking at, younger travelers, and they're trying to catch young travelers at a young age, even a school age, you know, to try and get them into this activity mindset, this experiential, this aspirational mindset where, you know, the holiday becomes you or you become the holiday, because so much of the imagery that you take during your trip is about you. And then, you know, obviously, as we said before, you share that online, people, your friends, your peers, your, you know, your school friends or whatever, take up those images and they want to go there. They want to do the same. It's a very status driven way of travel.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think another interesting way that tourism boards have been using this selfie culture is in Ayutthaya, which is in Thailand. Yeah. And what they have been doing is they are photo-shaming visitors.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that is that they are taking photos that have been shared by tourists themselves. So they're, you know, available already. And these are tourists who were taking pictures of themselves doing things like kissing or mimicking these religious carvings, because Ayutthaya, this is in the historical park especially, it's, you know, a place of religious significance for Thai people. So they're basically taking those photos of tourists who had taken photos of themselves doing all of these disrespectful things, climbing on the 700-year-old ruins and things, and posting it and kind of shaming them and warning visitors, actually, this is not the way that you should be behaving here. Yep. You need to behave with respect. And I think that's kind of fun that they're turning it back on themselves as well.
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting development because, as you said earlier, you know, there is this idea that perhaps selfie culture, if you upload these images of yourselves onto social media, that you do run the risk of being facially recognized. And you know, if you continue to do this in future, perhaps, you know, your visa would be denied or, you know, you'd be deported from a country. So there is definitely an element of sort of social policing here, which, you know, which your own pictures and irresponsible behavior could actually land you in big trouble.
Well, I think that brings us almost to an end of this week's show, but there's something we want to announce, isn't there, Gary?
Yeah, we are, Hannah. We're proud to launch the Southeast Asia Travel Show Cheat Sheet. So from today, from the 1st of April, you can download a free monthly summary of the key travel and tourism stories from across our region from our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com.
Yes. So we've already posted January, February, and the March editions of the cheat sheet on the website. And you can also sign up to receive it sent to you via a monthly newsletter as well, direct to your inbox. So drop us a message via Facebook at the SEA Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show, and we'll be posting the link to sign up on all of our social media channels too.
Yeah, we'll also post up the cover page as well, so that which is bright yellow. It's a beautiful design, which Hannah did.
Just cheerful yellow. That's what we need in this time.
And if you want to sign up, just drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com. Or as Hannah said, you can sign up from our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or any of our other social media sites.
Yep, so that is a wrap for this week's podcast. We're both off to snap photos of ourselves cooking dinner. So have a great week. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you soon.
Yep, see you soon. Bye-bye.